Good morning, Colorado, and welcome to the Daily Sun Up. It's Monday, November 9th, and we're feeling lucky to start the day with you. Every weekday, we're sharing a closer look at one of our top stories, followed by a quick summary of other important things happening in our state. Today, we're sharing an interview between Colorado Sun reporter Jesse Paul, Governor Jared Polis, and the state's top epidemiologist, Dr. Rachel Herlihy, about the coronavirus crisis in Colorado. Governor Polis and Herlihy were also featured in our last episode. On Friday, they answered our questions on everything from how their understanding of the virus has improved, what testing and treatment capacities look like, where they're seeing the most positive cases, and how they'd advise Coloradans to behave so that we can avoid a lockdown.
We really just want to follow up on a little about what you guys have been talking about, the recent press conferences and the current situation with COVID. And one thing I didn't get to ask yesterday that I think is kind of on a lot of people's minds is whether or not, you know, they should really be going outside of their households to businesses and restaurants in the next few weeks, given that you've told folks not to interact with other households. So I don't know what the difference is between going to another household and going to a restaurant or a retail store.
Yeah.
Is that something that folks should be avoiding right now as well?
So there's a big difference here. So the science shows that the biggest risk for transmission is if you're in that 10 to 15 minute range within 6 feet of somebody. That is what happens in a normal social environment when you see your friends. Sure, you're with them for more than 15 or 20 minutes. You might be with them for a few hours. And that is a much greater risk than going to a clothing store and buying a shirt and, you know, checking out while you're wearing a mask and the person behind the counter is wearing a mask. So there's just a very different risk profile. There's some people who understandably want to take extreme risks. And there's people who want to avoid extreme risks and might not want to go into stores. But there's just a very different risk profile between socializing indoors with friends and buying something at a store or, you know, sitting outside at a restaurant. If you're going to a restaurant, the most important thing is not going with another party outside of your household. That's the single biggest risk. So if you're, you know, meeting four other people from four different houses there, you are increasing the likelihood of you getting the virus exponentially. And that's what we want to avoid. So going out with your family, low to medium risk, right? If it's four people, five people, two people live under your roof, you go out, you're sitting outside, low to medium risk. The higher risk is if you're interacting with people from different households in sustained ways, especially indoors.
So I know I asked you this question yesterday, but I wanted to follow up and see if you could really talk in specifics about why a statewide stay-at-home order isn't appropriate now when it was in the spring when the coronavirus situation was just as bad, if not actually a little better. And I'm hoping both of you can really address this question.
So there's a lot of changes, first of all. I would say number one, in March and April, we had very little testing. Negligible testing relative to the size of the infection rate. So quite literally, it was impossible to find out who was contagious. It was impossible to screen asymptomatic people out from working in nursing homes and as first responders. We have increased to, you know, tens of thousands of tests a day, as many as are needed. We would love more people to get tested, frankly, but we have the equipment, we have the logistics. We're working on the deployment of the instant tests, doing more and more of those, which are not as accurate and they're not included in that daily data drop you see, but they're good for screening out asymptomatic. And then, of course, I think we had 30,000 in a day tests. So that's number one. Number two is we're learning a lot more about the virus. For instance, I believe it's low. Based on what we know, it's relatively low risk for younger kids to go to school. We did not know that as a fact in the last spring. So, you know, certainly on the K to five side, we see it as relatively low risk when they're following precautions. And frankly, you know, it's up to different parents and school districts, but high school is a little bit more difficult. But we don't see the same risk there that we see in other places. In all the schools, frankly, the biggest risk is other adults. So again, it's the faculty lounge, which hopefully they're not using. It's those kinds of interactions for the transmission, but masked students in a classroom with as much social distancing as possible with strong cohorting has demonstrated itself to be quite effective in preventing outbreaks in a disproportionate way. Meaning, are there kids that, and adults that get it at schools, of course, but there's no more that get it there than in any other kind of environment. In fact, in many, many ways less given the volume of education going on. Third, the treatment protocols have improved. In March, this is why avoiding that first wave and the extraordinary actions people took to stay home was so important. The fatality rate for people who were hospitalized was around 20%. One in five who entered the hospital in March and April didn't make it out. Now that's down to about 5%. Still very deadly, still tragic for many families, but one quarter the fatality rate of the initial wave. Fourth, we did what we said we would do, and expanded hospital capacity. One of the primary reasons for the extraordinary actions and work to stay at home that people took in March and April was we simply had our normal everyday hospital capacity, and it wasn't in any way, shape, or form prepared for this, either with supplies, with beds, with personnel, which, by the way, remains the most difficult, but on the beds and the supply side, significant expansions. It's not just the visible expansions that you know about, like the convention center, which thankfully we have not yet had to open and hope not to, but it's there, up to 2,000 beds. But every provider has made arrangements in the last few months to add ICU beds, to have a surge capacity. And so there's a lot more capability on that front than what we saw with those initial waves, especially in places like Italy and New York, right, where you know they just hit them big time, and there were people in hallways and cafeterias and gyms just as makeshifts getting subpar care, higher fatality rate, significantly reduced ability to do non-COVID related healthcare work. Remember, the majority of what our healthcare system handles is non-COVID related. It's every bit as important: heart attack, stroke, appendicitis, pneumonia, infection. I mean, bacterial infection. There's so many things we need to make sure that there's room for. So, as Dr. Birx put it, and I can't remember if I quoted to her, Jesse, but her public quote, and we had a really good private conversation, and she briefed our local public health authorities, but she said, quote, "This is not about lockdowns. It hasn't been about lockdowns since March or April. It's about an aggressive, balanced approach that's not being implemented," end quote. So at this point, people know what they need to do to contain the virus. How do we know that? They did it in August. We avoided that second wave that hit the Sun Belt states, and when we saw the rates start go up in July, people did it. We did it in August. The way we lived in August, the way we lived in early through mid-September, that's the way we need to live in November. We can't live like we did in October or late September. So just think of it like August. Avoid socializing outside of your home. That's the single biggest thing. And of course, wear a mask whenever you're around others.
Yeah, and this is Rachel. I would really just echo much of what the governor said, that our understanding of this virus has really evolved in the last couple of months, and so have the tools in our public health and our healthcare toolbox. We also have the mask order now. We have, in addition to testing capacity, we've expanded our PPE capacity. We've seen, even though we're still looking for cures and vaccine, we still have seen a lot of evolution of treatment of this virus. We've seen a shortened length of stay, increased survival, as the governor has mentioned. Our healthcare capacity has been expanded. We also have public health tools like case investigation and contact tracing, this new exposure notification tool. So we're in a very different place than we were several months ago.
So I wanted to ask, I know back when the stay-at-home order was issued in March, there were voices on both sides that were pushing and pulling at you, Governor. There was the economic, the business side that really didn't want you to do this, and then there were folks on the health side, and I know people within your own administration and other Democrats that wanted you to go that route. Is that happening again? And I wonder how much of the economic effects that these restrictions have factor into your decision-making about what restrictions to put into place?
I think that it's it's health, but there's more to health. I mean, it's, of course, there's psychological, behavioral health, there's physical health. Lockdowns are not healthy for people. I think we knew that in March, but we had to take the lesser of two evils given where we were. But lockdowns are very unhealthy for people. Mental health for kids and education, suicides go up, domestic abuse. People don't go to doctor's appointments for other conditions. You know, it's a horrible situation to have to choose between the lesser of two evils. But I do not think we are near the point where a lockdown is the lesser of two evils. I think a lockdown would be worse for the public health because sustenance is also a part of public health. I mean, people's ability to not be homeless and pay their rent and buy groceries and earn money. So it's all part of the larger public health picture. And I made the call in March based on the evidence. And I just see a different level of preparation today. But both paths are horrific for the people of Colorado, which is why I were hoping that folks are simply avoiding socializing with people outside their households to avoid further loss through coronavirus or further health loss through stay-at-home requirements.
So maybe we can just kind of answer this question once and for all and stop these questions about it. Would you say that a lockdown, a statewide lockdown, again, would be 100% off the table?
It's a very blunt instrument. I certainly hope that we've progressed far enough in these other areas. But look, if the convention center is filling up and there's not enough beds, then we simply look at the lesser of two evils and the calculation might change. But certainly, I share the goal of everybody in Colorado to avoid a lockdown, really, however we can. The public health toll and the economic toll of lockdowns is extensive. As Dr. Berg said, and as we believe, there's a number of other more focused tools that we couldn't even dream about having in that first wave. So, we want to deploy those tools fully.
Dr. Early, I had a question for you. Pueblo and now Denver today have enacted these overnight curfews as a way to try and slow the spread of the virus. I wonder if you think that's going to work, because I was pressing the folks in Denver today about that, and they didn't really provide evidence on exactly why they felt like it would prove to bear out. And I'm wondering if you can also talk about specifically where you guys are seeing the most transmission of the disease right now across the state.
Sure. So I think those are actually related questions. If we're talking about where we're seeing transmission as far as age groups, we continue to see the highest rates of disease transmission occurring in 20-somethings and 30-somethings. And we do know that that population is the group of individuals that is probably most likely to be out in the evenings, to be socializing, to potentially be in households or bars or other locations where transmission could readily occur. We also know that when alcohol is involved, that individual judgment can lapse, and that can certainly contribute to risky behavior and transmission of the virus. And so I think that looking at curfews or other restrictions in movement at certain times of day, I think is a strategy potentially that can reach populations and age groups that are more likely to be out and about and potentially contributing.
And I wanted to ask, too, about contact tracing. I know there's been reports across the country that it's not really possible anymore with the number of cases. And I think when we had spoken last time, the capacity of the state was about 500 people or so that could be contact traced, 500 cases or so a day. Are we being able to keep up with the current caseloads, given that we're having 2,000 to 3,000 new cases every day?
Sure. So there certainly is strain on our public health systems. There's strain in our contact tracing systems. I think that's part of the reason that this new exposure notification tool is really important. We know that that's another tool in our toolbox now to reach individuals and to make sure that individuals who have potentially been exposed know about that exposure and know that they need to quarantine and get testing, and that's all really critically important to prevent that next generation of cases.
With the rising number of cases and some of these new restrictions being come into place, do you think that we'll be able to have a full ski season here in Colorado with visitors coming from out of state and out of country?
Yeah, so look, skiing itself and boarding is a low-risk activity. You're outdoors, you're on a slope, you're not near anybody for very long, if at all. You're frequently masked anyway, even regardless of the pandemic, people wear ski masks. The issue is, you know, behavior in town and bars and restaurants. And so that's really what the ski counties, to preserve the ski season and to be a safe place for people from across the country to visit, have really taken strong action on. Some of them have additional masking requirements in their downtown areas. Many of them have worked with their restaurants to have more outdoor dining, which is challenging in a cold winter environment that usually featuring heating and other types of improvements. I saw one of them converted old gondolas into dining cars that are outside for outdoor dining. So a lot of creativity. But yeah, we've been pushing outdoors, as you know, all summer. That doesn't change in winter. Outdoors is better, and skiing and boarding are great. But you know, it's one of those things where if you want to be safe, just go home or go to your hotel after you are done skiing or boarding for the day. The dangers are not on the slope. The biggest danger on the slope continues to be slamming into a tree.
Appreciate both your time, Governor and Dr. Hurley.
Thank you. Take care.
Thanks for listening. Now let's go back in time with some Colorado history, adapted from historian Derek R. Everett's book, Colorado Day by Day. Today, we take you back to November 9th, 1871, which is Florence Sabin's birthday. Dr. Florence Sabin reinvented knowledge of the lymphatic system, blood flow, and tuberculosis, a disease she knew well from her Colorado childhood. Later, she was the first woman hired by the Rockefeller Institute in New York City. At age 70, she retired and moved back to Denver to live with her sister. You can see her statue today in Washington, D.C. Finally, here are a few stories you should know about today. At the Colorado Capitol, dozens gathered to celebrate Joe Biden's victory after the presidential race was called. Donald Trump supporters were there too, questioning the results. In the U.S. Senate, Colorado is now represented by two politicians whose biographies are so similar they look identical at face value. John Hickenlooper and Democratic incumbent Michael Bennett both graduated from Wesleyan University, a small liberal arts school in Connecticut, and both made millions in business in Colorado before turning to politics. But they are expected to go different directions in Washington. At least six Colorado school districts have reported coronavirus outbreaks among transportation employees. One of the larger outbreaks affected employees at a bus terminal for Jeffco Public Schools. Colorado officials anticipated a diverse group of more than 1,000 applicants would be interested in serving on each of two panels voters created to redraw electoral representation districts. Instead, they got a fraction of that number, and a group that does not reflect the diversity of the state. Voters in Colorado, Florida, and Alabama passed ballot measures Tuesday that codify what is already law, that only U.S. citizens 18 and older can vote. The passage of the largely symbolic measures has triggered questions about why the pro-Trump group behind them spent time and money on the effort. For more information on all these stories, visit our website, www.coloradosun.com. And remember, the Colorado Sun is nonpartisan and completely independent. We're always dedicated to telling the in-depth stories we need today more than ever. And the Sun is supported by readers and listeners like you. Right now, you can head to coloradosun.com and become a member. Starting at $5 per month for a basic membership, and if you bump it up to $20 per month, you'll get access to our exclusive politics and outdoors newsletters. Thanks for starting your morning with us, and don't forget to tune in again tomorrow.